Hello everybody and welcome to this video, which is kindly sponsored by Squarespace. Today we're going to look at how to add something to a virtual sales portal. So here's the Vic Chiller's Yard on my website with a few things that are already there, and we're going to add a copy of my book on HMS Belfast. Now I'm not competing with USNI or Amazon. This is if you want a signed copy and you've somehow missed out, or you have trouble getting a copy in your country for whatever reason. So obviously you select a physical product and you put in the description and add a picture. And then once you've done that, select your price and how many you've got in stock. So I'm just going to use the UK RRP of the book, and don't have unlimited stock, so I'm going to change that to 10. And fortunately, there is an option for me to tell it what the dimensions of the book are, or the dimension of the package, and how much it'll weigh, which then allows it to calculate shipping wherever you happen to be, rather than me having to look it up for infinite numbers of countries. And then you can set a release date. In this case, I'm going to set it for the end of this month, because I hopefully will have 10 copies of the book in hand by that point. And the captains on Patreon will hopefully have had their copies shipped out as well. So that's all done, set to release 10 a.m. UK time. And it's all there ready to go in the Vic Chiller's Yard. Nice and simple.
So if after all these little mini tutorials I've been doing, you think you could build a website for maybe ideally naval history purposes, but you never know, you might want to do it for some other reason, then head over to squarespace.com/Drakenefell. You can get a free trial. And once you're ready, that little link will give you 10% off your first website or domain. So thanks once again to Squarespace for sponsoring the video, and on with the main show.
Hi everyone, sorry this video is coming out on a Monday. It was supposed to come out last Friday, but shenanigans meant it didn't, so now you get it here. Something that comes up occasionally in comments and so forth is the question of how far can you actually hit things with carrier aircraft in World War II? I suppose that also applies to before World War II and after World War II, but given the nature of the channel, World War II is the main subject. The problem is that looking at very basic facts and figures can often cause confusion. For example, in the last action of the Battle of Midway, when the Mikuma and Mogami were attacked and the former was sunk, the contact was initially reported to be about 200 miles away from the remaining operational US carriers. But this caused a huge argument aboard the Enterprise over how to load the aircraft due to concerns from the pilots about having enough fuel to come back, especially if they were loaded out with the heavy 1,000-pound bombs. Likewise, at the end of the Battle of the Philippine Sea, the Japanese fleet was reported to be initially around 275 and later about 325 miles away. And of course, as we know in that engagement, quite a few aircraft didn't make it back due to lack of fuel. But if you look up the range of a Dauntless, you'll get various figures depending on its make and model, as well as which source you're using, but they all suggest that a Dauntless has a range somewhere in the region of 1,100 miles or so. A Wildcat can do 850 miles, a Hellcat 975 miles, and an Avenger 905 miles. And this isn't ferry range, which is of course a one-way trip. This is just range. And even if this is one-way range, by simple division and using the shortest range aircraft out of those, the Wildcat should still be able to make a 350-mile trip out and back again, and still have a reasonable reserve of fuel to hang around over its target, the other aircraft even more so. So what's the difference between these stated figures and actual practical reality? Because obviously, the ranges these aircraft were getting in real life are much lower than what these basic figures would suggest. So are those range figures wrong? Well, not necessarily, but they are perhaps over-idealized. So today we're going to briefly go over various internal and external factors that could affect the actual range of an aircraft that's operating from a carrier. Now, some of these issues are common to pretty much any aircraft, including those that fly from land, like strategic bombers, but I'll leave Military Aviation History, Rex's Hangar, or IHYLS to explain those weird non-moving airstrip-based aircraft to you in more detail. Let's just stick with the ones that are at sea. Now, I'm going to highlight six factors in each section. So, starting with external, factor one is targets move. Now, this is far more of a problem for sea-based aircraft or aircraft attacking things at sea as compared to aircraft attacking things on land, since prior to the advent of municipal Darwinism, cities tend to stay in the last place that you left them. Ships, on the other hand, tend to move around. Now, even assuming that your scouting report was actually accurate for where the target was, and that's being generous, especially early on in the war, if the target can move at, let's say, a relatively pedestrian for World War II speed of 26 knots, then if it's going to take you a couple of hours to fly out to where the target is, it potentially could have moved another 60 miles in that time. And if, say, your cruise speed is 180 miles an hour, which would be roughly in the ballpark for a strike aircraft, you now need to spend another 20 minutes flying around to get to the target, assuming you know which direction to go. And in that time, the target will have moved another 10 miles. And now, granted, you'll only need a few more minutes to chase the target down at this point, but overall, that adds up to another just under 30 minutes added to your flight one way. And if the target was just steaming directly away from you, then that's added another hour to the time that you're going to need to spend in the air if you want to attack the target and then get home again. So in this case, your flight time's just jumped from 4 hours, plus a little bit of time to actually attack the target, to 5 hours, a 25% increase, which means you're going to need to make allowances for the enemy making life difficult for you by moving around in this regard for your calculations. Second is the fact that you don't actually head off immediately. When you're launching a carrier strike, you at the very minimum need to wait for the rest of your squadron to get airborne. And while you're circling at low altitude, you're burning a bunch of fuel that you then can't use to go and fly after your enemy, or indeed fly home. Now, of course, the very last aircraft to make it off the deck doesn't face this issue, but unless you only want to get that aircraft back, you then need to make your range calculations based on how much fuel the first aircraft to take off has left in its tanks when you set out. Now, along with their generally longer-ranged aircraft, this was one of the things that helped the Imperial Japanese Navy in the early to mid part of the Pacific campaign, as by launching smaller groups from each carrier and then sending them off rapidly, combining up with other carriers' aircraft, they minimized the amount of fuel wasted waiting for other aircraft. Whereas early war US practice could leave the first aircraft circling for anywhere between 45 minutes to almost an hour and a half, waiting for everyone else to get off the deck, and thus shortening the range of the entire strike package. Factor number three is you don't fly straight at the target. Now, as previously covered, targets move, but you only have a rough idea where they might be going, unless, of course, you have continuous scouting reports. So usually, you'll either head for the last known location of the enemy and then spread out, or you need to make a guess at where you think the enemy is going to be once you get there, and head in that direction. That latter approach, taken individually by most of the US formations at the Battle of Midway, is why the various dive and torpedo bomber squadrons ended up all over the place. But of course, this means you are probably going to end up flying in at least a partial dogleg to find your target, plus you might not want to give away where your carrier is by flying straight from your carrier to the target, because then your line of approach gives a big this way back to our carrier indicator. And so you might intentionally fly a dogleg course anyway, both there and back, so that any counterstrike that's based on your direction of travel will miss your carriers. And all of that means that despite the as the crow flies distance between your carrier and the target, you will actually be flying a longer distance and thus using more fuel. Fourth, you might not be flying at optimal speed. Now, while an aircraft might have an optimal cruising speed, you might be forced to fly at a different speed to that. As a fighter pilot, for example, you might have to slow down or weave to keep pace with slower attack aircraft. Or, as a strike aircraft, you might be forced to throttle up past your ideal speed for cruising if hitting the target before a certain time, like hitting it before sunset so you can get back in a condition that's not pitch black, or perhaps getting to an enemy carrier quickly so that they can't launch a counterstrike, might be more important than optimal fuel use. Fifth, weather. Various weather conditions could also affect how much fuel you use. For example, is the air cold or hot? Is it dry or humid? Is the wind with you? Is the wind against you? Is the wind coming from the side? Is the air calm? Is there turbulence? Is it raining? All of these and more can affect how much fuel you use per mile and thus affect your overall range. Now, of course, some of these might be beneficial to you, say if the wind is with you, but they might also be against you. So, for example, even if the wind is with you in one way, then, well, when you're coming back the other way, it's probably going to be against you unless it happens to shift. Alternatively, if you're really, really unlucky, the wind might be against you going out, and then around the time you attack your target, it might be also against you coming back because it might change again, and so on and so forth. And then finally, sixth, you might not find the target where you expect it to be. Now, this is related to the first 2 points, especially not flying straight at a target, but the simple fact of the matter is that if you end up missing the target, either because you guessed wrong as to where they were in or the initial location report happened to be completely wrong anyway, you're going to have to search for them. And of course, that search might not succeed, but just making the effort will cost you more fuel. And since nothing is certain in these kinds of engagements, again, unless you happen to have a scout orbiting and continuously reporting where the target is, or the target is land-based and your navigation is pretty good, you need to factor in some allowance in your fuel for searching for the enemy into your calculations. Otherwise, you're gambling pretty much everything on a series of educated guesses, and then just hoping your one single roll of the dice comes up a six. So those are all your external factors, but what about the internal factors inherent to the aircraft? Because in theory, all of the external stuff could, in certain situations, be optimized, and then you might think, well, surely that will extend range. Well, yes, but then there's the stuff internally. So first on our list, payload weight. Because for an aircraft to fly, it has to generate enough lift to counter the effects of gravity. And of course, doing that requires energy from the engine, and the engine burns fuel to get that energy. If the aircraft weighs more, shockingly, then you need more lift if you want to fly at a given speed or altitude. And that means the engine needs to do more work, which means it's going to burn more fuel, which means your range is going to decrease. Conversely, if you fly with little to no additional munitions beyond the ammunition that's in your guns, your range increases as you need less fuel to haul you through the skies. So if you're loaded relatively lightly, let's say with a single 250 or 500 pound bomb, your aircraft is going to be able to go further than if you're carting around a 1,000 pounder, a 1,600 pounder, or a torpedo. This, incidentally, is one of the reasons why British intelligence made the miscalculations about the ranges of Japanese torpedo bombers in the 4Z incident. Because, yes, Singapore was being bombed at that point by Japanese bombers, but the bombs that were falling were pretty light, so the British had gone and decided, okay, well, if this is how far they can get with a relatively light bomb load, if we look at how far our bombers of a similar size can go with a similar light payload, and then compare how much their range is restricted by carrying a torpedo, therefore, roughly speaking, the Japanese bombers should also be restricted by that much, therefore this should be their approximate range. Of course, for various reasons, that turned out not to be the case, but they didn't know that at the time. Second is your payload type, specifically, not weight, but whether it's internal or external. Because as well as weight, different payloads affect range simply by their size and where they're positioned. A big 1,000 or 1,600 pound bomb, or a torpedo for example, is generally carried below the aircraft, in the airstream, with a big frontal cross section, and in the case of the torpedo, quite a large overall surface area as well. Now, this all creates drag, as do the hard points the weapons are mounted to, both in the form of air resistance, simply from their passing through the air and having to force it aside, but also in the form of various vortexes coming off the back of the weapons, which may not be optimized for traveling through the air at that kind of speed. All of this, of course, means that once again, fuel consumption usually goes up if you're carrying a lot of weaponry or a few big weapons. This is one of the reasons why recessed or semi-recessed carriage was often investigated and sometimes implemented, and why some aircraft enjoyed very large internal bomb bays, which remove this particular issue entirely, as they would be less affected for range compared to other aircraft that were carrying exactly the same payload, but externally. Third, combat versus cruise fuel consumption, and everything in between. Now, as anyone who's ever driven any vehicle powered by internal combustion will attest, engines all have a sweet spot for fuel efficiency. You can work out an overall range based on what you might term a cruise speed's fuel consumption, but an aircraft is not going to be able to fly at that speed all the time. If it's on an attack run, for example, the aircraft will have to move at a speed that's appropriate to that run. If they're attacked by enemy aircraft, they are very likely going to be pushing the throttle wide open to get maximum speed and or energy, depending on if they're going to try and dogfight or run. Takeoff and climbing also needs more power, and all of this is going to eat into your fuel reserves rather quickly. On World War II aircraft, and presumably modern ones as well, at least propeller-driven ones, there are also options for fuel-rich or fuel-lean settings in addition to your basic throttle settings. Obviously, a fuel-rich setting is going to use fuel faster, but you might have to use it in certain situations. Depending on the aircraft, all of these things might be controlled either manually or via an automatic setting in terms of your fuel mixtures. And if you want some idea of the difference, depending on the aircraft, the difference in fuel consumption between moving at cruise speed and moving at 100% throttle is something in the order of 3 times as much fuel with the throttle open as opposed to at cruise speed. The fourth factor is enemy opposition. Now, as we just covered, running at full power in combat uses fuel quite quickly, so you have to factor in an expected amount that you will be using in combat, but this is going to be governed by 2 main factors. The aircraft type, and the level of enemy opposition that you can reasonably expect. So fighters, for instance, might be expected to dogfight and need to defend both themselves and strike aircraft, so they might need quite a lot of fuel reserved for this activity. Whereas a strike aircraft, hopefully, will only need full combat power for its attack run and a quick sprint getting away from potential combat air patrol fighters as soon as possible. But if a lot of enemy opposition is expected, either because you know that the enemy carrier knows that you know that they're there, or you're going after an airfield and this is maybe the second or third strike wave, then you might need even more fuel for full power combat, as you might end up having to undertake quite extensive evasion and high speed runs in order to keep yourself safe. Fifth is the ideal altitude performance of your aircraft. Now, not only does fuel efficiency vary with speed, but even at the same speed, different aircraft can operate at different efficiency levels depending on what altitude they're at. At lower levels, there's more oxygen to help burn the fuel, but there's also a lot more air, and therefore a lot more air resistance. If you go to higher altitudes, there's less air resistance, which obviously means less energy needed to move through the air, but there's also less oxygen, which can lead to incomplete burning of your fuel, and thus drop your efficiency. Now, the implementation of superchargers, turbochargers, different sized air inlets, and many other factors, including different fuel mixes, could be brought in to try and address these issues, but you're always going to have an ideal altitude of some description. And even if your aircraft has an ideal altitude that is within your operational parameters, you still might not be able to fly at that level. Cloud cover up high, for example, might force an aircraft that's optimized for high-level cruise to fly somewhat lower, whereas a very low cloud base might force an aircraft that's actually quite good at low levels to fly high. And various other factors, such as where the strike aircraft are that you need to escort, could all play a role. And sixth is additional systems. Most factory figures will be calculated for range using a factory fresh version of the aircraft, whatever make and model it happens to be. But as time goes on in service, you usually find additional things are being added to it. Now, early in the war, that might be something like impromptu cockpit armor installed in F4 F3s. Later on, however, it might be IFF systems installed in early model Avengers that are still flying, or a brand new radio set, or a radar, or something like that. But in any case, almost all of these additions add weight, and occasionally also drag, and that increases your fuel consumption and therefore decreases range. Plus, you have to factor in that as an aircraft is used and survives combat, its engine will gradually wear out, regardless of how much maintenance you do, and thus your engine will become less and less efficient over time, Again, if you've ever driven an internal combustion engine vehicle for any amount of time, you'll know exactly what I mean. Now, a good example of all these factors combining comes from the official datasets for the Grumman Avenger. In this case, it covers the Grumman Avenger TBF and TBM-1C and related models. Both charts show range on the Y or vertical axis versus speed on the X or horizontal axis. The one on the left, as you can see, is for the altitude of 5,000 feet. The one on the right is for 15,000 feet. And you'll see each set of lines is labeled. Lines labeled 2 and 3 show the conditions for an Avenger carrying a Mark 13 torpedo in both cases, with 2 just being the Avenger on internal fuel, and 3 is an Avenger that's also carrying a pair of wing-mounted fuel tanks. The lines that have a 7 next to them indicate the middle of 3 potential scout or patrol setups, so not carrying weapons, and in this case carrying extra internal fuel. Now, you can immediately see the effect on range of simply carrying a torpedo. The addition of 116 gallons of fuel, or 34% more, for the lines labelled 3, doesn't give you a 34% increase in range, because the tanks and the extra fuel have weight which has to be carried around, and of course the tanks increase drag. So overall, you only get a 22 to 23% increase in range under the most optimal comparisons. But if you exchange all of that for a bit more fuel and no torpedo, the range skyrockets. In setting number 7 up top, the aircraft is carrying 275 more gallons internally than it does when it's carrying a torpedo, and it's carrying 159 more gallons than an aircraft that has a torpedo and 2 external tanks. But although that's an increase of 82% and 35% more fuel, respectively, the aircraft has 95% and 54% more range, respectively, again at the optimal comparisons at the lower speeds, showing the significant effect of reducing both weight and drag by removing external stores and inert munitions. For reference, the takeoff weight of an Avenger that's in the condition number 7 at the top is roughly similar to that of an Avenger that's just carrying the Mark 13 torpedo, that's the lines labelled 2, and the condition 3, the one with the Avenger with a torpedo and 2 external tanks, is about 900 to 1,000 pounds more on takeoff at around 17,350 pounds as compared to the other two. Now, you can also see how moving at a slower cruising speed gives more range, which indicates greater efficiency, but then how at various speeds efficiency and thus range will decrease. In each configuration, there's also a cutoff where these figures start to drop off extremely rapidly as airspeed and resistance increases. Unsurprisingly, the less external drag there is, the faster you can go before this factor sets in. Another interesting fact is that the Avenger is generally more fuel efficient at 5,000 feet than at 15,000 feet, but when it's pushed to high speeds, that actually flips round. For example, the Patrol Avenger, moving at 250 miles an hour at a higher altitude, has a range on paper of 1,000 miles, whereas lower down at 5,000 feet, that range is only about 940 miles. Whereas at 170 miles per hour, at the lower altitude, you can go 2,050 miles, compared to only 1,950 miles if you're at high altitude. Now, if we go to the overall tables that these graphs are based upon, you can see that a torpedo-armed Avenger is given a combat radius, about halfway down the page there, of just 225 miles. Now, if you add external tanks for Condition 3, the first one being Condition 2, that pushes the combat range up to just 350 miles. But we're back down to 225 miles if we swap out the torpedo and tanks for 400 or 500 pound bombs. And then if we head over to the latter conditions and we give it a single 1,000 pounder, the range goes up slightly to 235 miles. But then if we strip out all the ordnance from the bomb bay and so forth, the first scout configuration has a scout radius of 340 miles, put more fuel in an internal tank, it goes up to 580 miles, and the most fuel, which is an internal and the 2 external tanks, you get 645 miles. But why are all these figures so much lower than the ranges from the tables we were looking at a minute ago, which are part of the same document? Well, firstly, this is radius as opposed to range. If you look a few lines above combat radius, you'll see that maximum range is considerably higher, because of course with a radius, you have to come back. But the radius is still well below 50% of the maximum range. Well, that's all explained by this note, which is also found in the document, and you'll see that practical scouting radius is considered to be 1/3 of possible range when in cruise mode at 1500 feet, with a margin removed to allow for 20 minutes of the engine warming up and idling on the flight deck, plus a minute at full throttle for takeoff, which is going to use a lot of fuel, and then another 60 minutes of fuel, which is allowed for meeting up with other aircraft, landing, which may involve circling the carrier for a while, and a little bit of a reserve for emergencies. Because, of course, remember, if you're scouting, you don't just go out to a point and come back. You go out to a point, then search around that area, and then you come back. The calculation for combat radius is a bit more complex. This allows for 20 minutes warming up and idling on the flight deck, then another minute for full power at takeoff, like with the scout. But then you have a bunch of additional fuel amounts that are removed from overall combat radius, starting with 10 minutes of fuel burn at 60% throttle using a rich fuel mixture, which allows the aircraft to meet up with its squadron and escorts. Then they assume the same 60% throttle setting, but with a lean fuel mixture, and this will be used to climb to 15,000 feet. After which, the same 60% throttle and lean fuel mixture will be used to cruise to its target. Then there's an allowance for 5 minutes of combat at full military power down at 1500 feet, then another 10 minutes at full throttle, assuming presumably that you're running away from combat air patrol fighters or something, and then there's an assumption that you're cruising home again at your 60% throttle setting, but now down at 1500 rather than 15,000 feet using a lean fuel mixture. And then there's a 60 minute margin for landing and reserve fuel. And of course, all of this is just for one model of one type of aircraft, in this case operated by both the US and Royal Navies. But the same general principles will hold true across most carrier aircraft, and aircraft in general. So always bear in mind that when a website or a publication gives an absolute range figure, then yes, in theory, the aircraft can go that far. But in practice, if you want it to actually reach its target with a reasonable weapons load, potentially in the face of enemy opposition, then realistically it's only going to be going a fraction of that range. Now, of course, if you're trying to evaluate enemy aircraft using your own varying figures like this as a baseline, well, you've got to be pretty good at estimating their base range in the first place, which was the downfall of British planners around Force Z, amongst other things. Otherwise, of course, you can end up over or underestimating an enemy's capabilities, and if you do the latter, well, that doesn't usually end very well. But I hope that overall this has given you some insight into why aircraft carriers in World War II don't generally like being more than a couple of hundred miles from their targets when at sea, unless they happen to be Japanese, and ideally, a bit less. Even when they're on paper figures at their most basic, might suggest that this is actually a really easy distance to cover.